Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dorothy Gundy, Phil Dierking, and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dorothy Gundy.
For years, European and American researchers dug up land where Native Americans buried their dead. They recovered countless bones and cultural artifacts as part of their studies. Now, museum officials have begun returning some of these artifacts to Native American tribes. Late last month, the Prussian Cultural Heritage Foundation returned 9 such objects to the Alaskan Native Chugach tribe. The objects included a wooden mask, a wooden idol, and a basket for carrying a baby. They were taken by a Norwegian explorer, Johan Adrian Jacobsen, in the late 1800s. He found them in tribal lands along the northwest coast of North America. Jacobsen gave the artifacts to the Royal Museum of Ethnology in Berlin. They were stored for many years at Berlin's Ethnographic Museum. Hermann Parzinger is president of the Prussian Cultural Heritage Foundation. He said that since the artifacts were taken from the Chugach people without their approval, they do not belong to the museum.
John F.C. Johnson is with the Chugach Alaska Corporation. He represented the tribe in Berlin at a ceremony marking the official return of the 9 artifacts. Johnson told VOA that for years he has traveled to Europe to document all the objects taken from the tribe's territory. He plans to create an online registry showing where the artifacts can be found around the world. The process for returning the mask, baby's basket, and other objects began in 2015. That is when a Chugach delegation visited the Berlin Museum to identify Chugach artifacts in its collection. Some of the artifacts were found to be funerary objects. Johnson said he does not expect that everything will be returned to the tribe, but it is important that funerary or religious objects are sent back. When we do reburials, different elders will say that it's a basic cultural value that you have to respect, honor, and give dignity to the human remains and funerary objects. If different cultural organizations or states went by those value systems, I think our world would be a lot better place to live in. After the German museum confirmed that the 9 objects had been taken without the tribe's approval, museum officials agreed to give them back. After the artifacts are officially returned to the Chugach, Johnson says they will be kept in local museums or community centers.
In the United States, the federal government is supporting Native Americans' efforts to recover lost or missing artifacts. The Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act requires museums to make Native American artifacts available to government-recognized tribes. Johnson said this means that if tribes wish to have objects returned from an American museum, they need to make an official request. However, European countries do not have such laws, so Native American tribes depend on the willingness of European museum officials to return artifacts. Johnson said that with Berlin's ethnographic museum, this was not a problem. People in Germany are doing it out of their own goodwill, and I'm really impressed with their efforts of doing that. Monica Zesnick is the curator of American ethnology at the Ethnographic Museum. She said the return of the artifacts was a first step in an ongoing cooperation between the museum and the Chugach people. She added that this event comes at a time when many museums in Europe are looking closely at how their artifacts were collected.
Zesnick said that working directly with tribal representatives helps museum officials widen their own knowledge about the artifacts in their collections. These are old collections of about 130 to 150 years, and evidence and information is sometimes very thin. It's really a lot of help for us for presenting collections, she noted. Johnson agrees and said the Chugach are working with the Berlin Museum for possible future exchanges. With Berlin, we're developing cultural exchanges where, in the future, we can have some of our members come to Berlin and see some of the collections, he said. Zesnick said that she and Johnson are also working on having the museum's members travel to Alaska to experience a Chugach culture camp called the Nuchik Spirit Camp. The camps bring the tribe's young and older members together for cultural programs such as dancing, language, art, and cooking. Johnson added that he would also like to see community artists create models of the returned artifacts, which they can then give to museums overseas. Zesnick said the two sides have discussed working together on a possible exhibition or a long-term loan of the more than 200 other Chugach objects the museum has in its collection.
This is not the only time a museum has returned artifacts back to Alaska natives. Last year, National Public Radio reported on the return of human remains to the small Yupik village of Igiagig from the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. Local tribal leaders accepted and later reburied the remains of their ancestors. The bones had been taken in 1931 by Aleš Hrdliška, the director of the museum's Department of Anthropology at the time. He dug them up as part of his research of how people first came to North America. In 2016, the Anchorage Daily News reported that two artifacts were returned to Alaska Native organizations after they were discovered on sale in Paris. After assistance from the U.S. State Department, the artifacts were purchased in secret by a nonprofit group, which then returned them to the tribes. The two objects were small wooden boxes belonging to the Chugach tribe and the Chilkat Tlingit tribe. Experts believe that at one time the boxes probably were used to transport important religious objects. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Phil Dierking.
In a recent program, we told you about phrasal verbs related to food. The program centered on eating food, what, how much, and when. You will remember that a phrasal verb is a verb made of two or more words, a verb plus a preposition or adverb or both. Today, we'll discuss phrasal verbs we use to talk about cooking. if you watch television cooking programs in English, you have already heard some of these verbs. Many are used in recipes. Listen to a recipe for pasta sauce. There are 7 phrasal verbs. Try to find them and think about their meanings.
Before you begin, thaw out the chicken for several hours. Okay, let's get started. First, chop up the tomatoes, onions, garlic, and mushrooms. Next, add these ingredients to a sauce pot with a little cooking oil and put it on medium heat for about 1 minute. Then, mix in the chicken, spices, and a little salt. Let the mixture cook until the chicken is golden, about 7 minutes. Next, add 2 large cans of crushed tomatoes. Cover the pot. Then, turn down the heat. Otherwise, the sauce may boil over. Let it cook for about 20 minutes on low heat. Then, let it cool down before serving it over pasta with a little Parmesan. And finally, warm up your garlic bread to complete the meal.
Did you find the 7 phrasal verbs? The first one was thaw out. To thaw out means to unfreeze. Listen to how this verb is used in the recipe.
Before you begin, thaw out the chicken for several hours.
Thaw out is separable. That means the object may go after the 2-word verb, or it may appear in the middle of it. The object is the chicken. Now listen to the sentence with the object in the middle.
Before you begin, thaw the chicken out for several hours.
Notice also that we use the imperative form because this is a recipe or a list of commands. In the imperative form, the subject you is not written or spoken. So instead of you thaw out, you hear thaw out. You'll hear the imperative for the remaining 6 verbs also. Our next verb is chop up, which is also separable. To chop up means to cut something into small pieces. Today's recipe involves chopping up vegetables. Listen.
First, chop up the tomatoes, onions, garlic, and mushrooms.
You could also say it with up after the object.
First, chop the tomatoes, onions, garlic, and mushrooms up.
But it is easier to understand if you do not separate chop and up when the object is a list of things. Mix in is another separable phrasal verb. To mix in means to add one substance to others, especially in cooking. Here's how the recipe uses the verb.
Then, mix in the chicken, spices, and a little salt.
Again, we are less likely to separate the verb because the object is a list of things. Now let's talk about turn down. In cooking, to turn down means to lower the temperature of the heat used to cook food. Here's how the recipe uses the verb.
Then, turn down the heat.
Since the verb is separable, you can also say it this way.
Then, turn the heat down.
Next, we have boil over, one of today's easier verbs, as it does not take an object. To boil over means to flow over the side of a container while boiling. Listen to how the recipe uses this verb and notice that it appears at the end of the sentence.
Otherwise, the sauce may boil over.
Has your cooking ever boiled over? Mine has. Okay, let's talk about cool down. In relation to food, the verb means to permit hot food to become cool enough to eat. In recipes, we often use cool down with the verb let. So the sentence structure is a little different. Listen.
Then, let it cool down before serving it over pasta with a little Parmesan.
The verb let is a causative verb. These verbs cause something to happen. After the causative verb let, we use the simple form of verbs rather than their infinitives. Notice in our recipe that we said, let it cool down, not let it to cool down. Our final phrasal verb for today is warm up, another separable verb. To warm up means to reheat a food to a desired temperature. Here's how the recipe uses this verb.
And finally, warm up your garlic bread to complete the meal.
Now that you know how separable phrasal verbs work, try writing this last example with the object, your garlic bread, in the middle of the verb. Most of the phrasal verbs you learned today are easier than some others in English. That's because the first words of these phrasal verbs tell us their meanings. And, in fact, often we use them as regular one-word verbs rather than phrasal verbs. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Doug Johnson and Shirley Griffith discuss the presidential election of 1920 and the man who won, Warren Harding.
The presidential election of 1920 was a turning point in American politics. It ended a period of social reforms at home and an active foreign policy. It began a period of conservative thinking in both the political and social life of the nation. American reporter H.L. Mencken described the national feeling this way. The majority of Americans are tired of idealism. They want capitalism, openly and without apology.
President Woodrow Wilson had suffered a stroke during his second term. He was very sick. No one expected him to be a candidate again. Yet he refused to announce that he would not run for a third term. Woodrow Wilson had done much during his administration. He helped pass important laws dealing with trade, banking, and the rights of workers. He led the nation through the bloody World War in Europe. He tried, but failed, to have the United States join the new international organization, the League of Nations. The American people honored Wilson for his intelligence and ideas, but they were tired of his policies of social change, and they did not want to be involved in international problems anymore.
The leaders of President Wilson's Democratic Party understood the feelings of the people. They knew they had little chance of winning the presidential election if they nominated a candidate of change. Delegates to the Democratic nominating convention voted 44 times before agreeing on a candidate. They chose the governor of the state of Ohio, James Cox. The Republican Party also had a difficult time at its nominating convention. four men wanted to be president. The delegates voted six times. None of the men gained enough support, so several party leaders met in private. They agreed that only one man, a compromise candidate, could win the support of the convention. He was a senator from the state of Ohio, Warren Harding. The delegates voted 10 more times before choosing Harding as their candidate for president. For vice president, they chose Calvin Coolidge of Massachusetts.
Warren Harding had owned a newspaper in Ohio. People advised him to enter politics because he was such a good public speaker. During the campaign, he promised lower taxes, less immigration, and more aid to farmers. He called for normalcy, a new period of peace and quiet with few changes. That is what the voters wanted to hear in 1920. Warren Harding won the election with 68% of the popular vote. In his first act as president, he invited people to visit the White House. He permitted them to walk in the garden. The act was a sign. The government seemed to be returning to the people.
Warren Harding is remembered mostly for two events. One was a successful international conference. The other was a shameful national incident. After World War I, Britain, Japan, and the United States expanded their navies. They built bigger and better ships. Many members of the United States Congress worried about the cost. They also worried about increased political tension in Asia. They asked President Harding to organize a conference to discuss these issues.
The conference was held in Washington in November 1921. President Harding invited representatives from the major naval powers of the time, Britain, Japan, France, and Italy. He also invited representatives from countries with interests in Asia, China, Portugal, Belgium, and the Netherlands. He did not invite the new Soviet leaders in Russia. Mr. Harding's Secretary of State, Charles Evans Hughes, spoke. He offered the conference a detailed plan to reduce the size of the world's major navies. He proposed that the world's strongest nations should stop building warships for 10 years. He also proposed that Britain, Japan, and the United States should destroy some ships to make their navies smaller immediately.
Delegates to the conference debated the plan for 3 months. Japan demanded and won the right to have more ships. But the final agreement was very close to the one proposed by Secretary Hughes. The conference was not a complete success. For example, it did not prevent countries from building some kinds of ships. These ships would prove important in the Second World War. Also, it did not create ways to protect China and the islands in the South Pacific Ocean from Japanese expansion. Yet the Naval Treaty of 1921 was the first in which the world's strongest countries agreed to reduce the size of their armed forces. Most people thought it was a good treaty.
The second thing for which President Harding is remembered is the Teapot Dome scandal. It involved the misuse of underground oil owned by the federal government. Warren Harding was an honest man, but he did not have a strong mind of his own. He was easily influenced, and he often accepted bad advice. He explained the problem with these words: "I listen to one side, and they seem right. Then I listen to the other side, and they seem just as right. I know that somewhere there is a man who knows the truth, but I do not know where to find him."
President Harding appointed several men of great ability to his cabinet. They included Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes, Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon, and Commerce Secretary Herbert Hoover. However, some of his appointments were dishonest men. One was Interior Secretary Albert Fall. He was responsible for the Teapot Dome scandal. Secretary Fall gave a private company the right to take oil from land owned by the federal government. In return, the company gave him money and cattle. The oil was not supposed to be taken from the ground. It was supposed to be saved for the United States Navy to use in an emergency. Private oil companies and many politicians opposed this policy. They said saving the oil was unnecessary.
Albert Fall opposed the policy when he was a member of the Senate. When he became Interior Secretary, his department took control of the lands containing the underground oil. Then he permitted private companies to use the land for a period of time. During that time, the companies could take out the oil. Some of the oil was in the western state of Wyoming. The rock mass on the surface looked like a container for making tea, so the area was called Teapot Dome. When the Senate uncovered Secretary Fall's wrongdoing, the press quickly called the incident the Teapot Dome scandal. The Senate investigation led to several court cases which lasted throughout the 1920s. Secretary Fall was found guilty of misusing his government position. He was sentenced to prison for 1 year.
President Harding did not live to see the end of the Teapot Dome incident. In the summer of 1923, he made a political trip to Alaska and western states. On the way home, he became sick while in San Francisco. He died of a heart attack. Vice President Calvin Coolidge was in the northeastern state of Vermont when he heard that President Harding had died. Coolidge's father was a local court official there. He gave the oath of office to his son. That is how Calvin Coolidge became the 30th President of the United States.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.